And by the way, someone will say, well, this is a ridiculous episode because everyone's a whiskey company. And if you got to this far and that was your take from this episode, I'm just going to say, you don't get it.
This is Bourbon Pursuit, the official podcast of bourbon, bringing to you the best in news, reviews, and interviews with people making the bourbon whiskey industry happen, and I'm one of your hosts, Kenny Coleman. The title of today's show is a question that has plagued me for quite some time, and it was actually inspired by my wife. Ryan and I, we continuously evaluate brands as we compare what works and what doesn't when it comes to consumers and their kind of mindset. And we got in this trap of continually pivoting as we see other brands catch fire because there's a bottle design or maybe it's just some element that people start gravitating towards. But my wife asked me, she goes, Kenny, are you a whiskey company or are you a marketing company? It caught me off guard and I had really no idea what to think about it because you look at the broader landscape and I figured, well, let's go ahead and let's make an episode where we talk about what it takes to be a whiskey company versus just being a marketing company. And there's probably a lot of brands out there that they think of themselves as a whiskey company, but in reality, they're really just a marketing company. And here's the thing, there's no wrong answer. Marketing plays a crucial role in whiskey, and it could be the marketing that's in your face through a point of sale. It could be a bottle shape, or even lack of marketing that helps keep that mystique alive. I thoroughly enjoyed this conversation, and it probably requires us to hit on this topic again in the future. So if you can, send us your feedback, and we'll think about doing it. But with that, enjoy this week's episode. And now here's Fred Minnick with Above the Char.
I'm Fred Minnick, and this is Above the Char. This week's idea comes from Kevin Radowitz, who writes me on fredminnick.com. I just finished your book, Bourbon, The Rise, Fall, and Rebirth of an American Whiskey. I really enjoyed it. It's very interesting. Well, thank you, Kevin. He writes, I had no idea the Maker's Mark was so critical in bourbon's initial growth spurt and the founding father of bourbon's Kentucky Bourbon Trail. Well, that's exactly right, Kevin, and thank you for the kind words on my book, Bourbon. By the way, to this point, that has been like my favorite book I've ever written due to the research and some of the things that have never been published before that were published in that book. All my books are important, but that one is very, very, very special to me. But yeah, so Maker's Mark is this brand. They come out in the 1950s with a different package. They were like a red dress and a sea of gray bottles. You know, they literally had like red dripping wax on there. They had this motto, it tastes expensive, it is. They were like $1, $2 more expensive than everybody else on the shelf. And they were absolutely not doing well in the 60s. They were like everybody else in the bourbon community. They were losing money because of vodka's growth, but they just kind of kept going at it and going at it. And they were real clever with their marketing. They hired a firm out here in Louisville called Doe Anderson, who just was so innovative in working with Bill Samuels Jr. And they came up with all these clever marketing ideas in the 70s through the early 90s. But my favorite thing that they did, their sole mission was to go after Jack Daniels. And to this day, chasing Jack Daniels is a strategy for every whiskey brand coming on the market because they're the number one in the world. Well, they would follow them everywhere. And to the point, they actually found somebody in Mississippi by the name of Jack Daniel. They hired this person and they dressed them up and they had them take a picture like they were Jack Daniels, like he looks like the iconic Jack Daniel, and they put Maker's in his hand, and they're like, even Jack Daniels loves Maker's Mark, and they bought all these ads in the country over it, and there's a few other things that they were doing that was getting under the ruffles of Brown-Forman, and that's one of the reasons why they started Woodford Reserve was to get Maker's Mark off of Jack Daniels' back, and truthfully, Woodford Reserve was a really good rival, especially tourist-wise, for Maker's Mark. Now, speaking of tourism, Marjorie Samuels, who's in my a prominent part of one of my other books called Whiskey Women and is in the Bourbon Hall of Fame, she is noted for starting to do tours and giving people tours in the 1960s. And she had a belief of like preserving the history side and how preserving how the distillery looked for tourism perspective. So they kind of laid the groundwork for giving a tour. And, you know, in the 1960s, 1970s, nobody was doing that. Nobody cared about visiting a distillery tour. So yeah, they were so important for the growth of bourbon. And for a long time, man, that was the brand that chefs wanted. That was the brand that was considered super premium until the bourbon boom came on strong and you started seeing Pappy Van Winkle take off and you saw the Buffalo Trace Antique Collection take off and Fort Rose limited edition small batch. People's go-to for like high-end bourbon was Maker's Mark. Maker's Mark was the high-end bourbon for most of the 70s, 80s, and early 90s. But here's the deal too. Like I've had a lot of those 1970s Maker's Marks. I mean, they'll change your world. They're incredible. So the whiskey that they were drinking in the 70s, probably a little older, and boy, it sure tasted good. Today's Maker's is great too, though, especially for the price point. They do have some more premium selections, of course. The Cellar's Age one is their latest. That's been turning a lot of heads, including mine. But yeah, so Maker's is, without Maker's Mark, I don't know if the bourbon boom ever gets out of the way of vodka. I don't know if they ever supplant vodka or ever get vodka out of its shadow without Maker's Mark. There were other brands doing great things. Evan Williams, Jim Beam, Wild Turkey were all doing exceptional things, but they were not targeting the chef. They were not targeting the person with a private plane like Maker's Mark was. So they were so huge for bourbon. But that's a great comment that kind of led into an above the char. So I appreciate that, Kevin. If you want to be like Kevin, hit me up on fredminnick.com. That's fredminnick.com. Click the contact button. And if I like the idea, I'll read it on the air. Till next week. Cheers.
And they're off for another Get 270 2020 Unicorn Raffle. Your $20 ticket gives you not one, but two chances to win from our lineup of 20 Woodford Reserve treasures, including the grand prize, the rarest unicorn yet, the Woodford Reserve Kentucky Derby 150 Baccarat Edition. Only 150 bottles were made and is just like the one the Derby winning owner receives. Quit horsing around and get your $20 tickets now at give270.org. Charitable gaming license ORG 0002703.
From their bar to yours, Chad and Sarah of the popular YouTube channel It's Bourbon Night bring you their favorite at-home old-fashioned mix with the new Elemental Elixirs Golden Hour Syrup. It's a custom-made syrup with notes of bold black tea, warm spices, and orange zest. All you need is your favorite whiskey and ice. No bitters needed. One bottle makes 16 drinks, so that's only $1 cocktail before you add your own whiskey. They can also be enjoyed in other cocktails or spirits, mocktails, coffee, tea, and anything you can think of. It's crafted locally in Lexington, Kentucky, and you can get your bottle now at whiskeyambitions.com. Ed Bly and Rising Tide Spirits are back again with a new release of Old Stubborn Bourbon. And this release of Old Stubborn is a premium hand marriage of 10, 11, and 12-year cask strength, barely filtered pot still bourbon. It comes in at a staggering 123.8 proof. And the flavoring grain for this one, which the last one was wheated, but this time it's now rye. Rich, sweet, and bold with a long finish that's sure to be another eye-opener. You can order online at Sealbox or thebourbonconcierge.com, and you can even purchase in person at Revival Vintage Spirits and even now with very few select stores in Kentucky. You can get it now while you can, but be sure to do it because it's not going to last long. Hey everybody, welcome back. It's another brand new episode of Bourbon Pursuit, the official podcast of bourbon. It's Kenny.
And I'm Ryan.
Fred Minnick here.
And this is not above the chart, but this is another great episode. And this is one where we don't want to make enemies in this space. And it's not what this is going to be, because the topic of today is, are you a whiskey company or are you a marketing company? And the way to kind of picture this is that there's some brands that come out there and they put their bottles on the shelf, and it doesn't really matter what's in the bottle. The bottle itself or the story itself sells. And on the other hand, people really put a focus on developing their whiskey to have the whiskey really shine through. And they don't really put much attention into the story or the packaging or anything like that. And there's no wrong way or right way. In fact, it might actually be, you might have to take some points from both sides, because even if you have really good whiskey, you might have a really bad marketing angle.
Oh, that's all the time.
And maybe at the end of the day, the marketing angle is really just what wins, because all you really need is something in the bottle that sells. So I want to kind of dive into this.
Are we sending parameter? Are we talking from distilled brands, non-distilling producers, everything?
Yeah, okay. I guess
everything. And I mean, I think the easiest way to look at it as a kind of a baseline is to look at non-distilling producers. We have talked about this ad nauseum when we talk about source brands, that all they do is they buy some whiskey, notably probably from MGP, Wilderness Trail, Bardstown, Barton, you name it. They don't do anything to it, right? They cash drink, single barrel it. They just put it in a bottle, whatever their bottle looks like, and they put it on the shelf. How would you define that? Are you a whiskey company or are you a marketing company?
Well, I think you got to start with, like, where do they spend their money? And I would say before they are a whiskey or marketing companies, they're proud tax-paying companies.
Because they,
you all, and I say you all because you all own a brand, that you all spend so much money on taxes, it's ridiculous. But so I'd say that's the first check you got to write. I had this interview with Stephen Thompson a long time ago, and he broke down the economics of bourbon for me better than anybody. And he talked about, like, how much it takes to go from the corn to the fermentation, all that stuff, and just assuming that the equipment and all that's paid for, just the raw ingredients to the bottle. And this was 2015, so obviously the prices have changed. He said most brands are getting into the bottle with glass, everything, before really any marketing has been done, around $6, you know, $6, $10 a bottle if they're distilling it themselves. That goes up if they're buying it, of course. Again, that's changed over the years. He said after that, you got some costs and some taxes, but after that, every little price increase is due to marketing. And they may price out something, and that would also be on a 4 to 6 year old product. That would not be a 15 to 20 something year old product. But he said, after that, every single price increase is a marketing. It's a marketing inside the liquor store or the bar. It's a marketing into the trades. It's the PR team behind it. It's the advertisements they do. And now social media and digital buys. And he broke all of this down for me, that put it in such a way that I was like, wow, marketing may be more important than the whiskey itself by his discussion. He's like, well, if your whiskey's shitty, it doesn't matter. So that brought me back to ground zero with it. And of course, Stephen Thompson was the former president of Brown-Forman. He founded Kentucky Artisan Distillery. He passed away, I think, last year, 2 years ago. He was in the Bourbon Hall of Fame. Just an incredible brain and a person to talk to about whiskey. And that guy was a no-bullshit guy. And we had this conversation back and forth. I never came to a conclusion, and he never offered, in his years of wisdom, a conclusion either. It's kind of like it's a both, but we see so many companies fail miserably on one or the other. And that's where I think the perfect scenario is the balance. But we see more failures than I think we see balance.
Yeah, I think when you think of something like that, one of the brands that kind of comes to mind of one that failed, do you remember Big Ass Bourbon?
Still have a bottle of them.
Okay, yeah, where it just had a big donkey on it, right? I mean, like, that is a pure example of something that is probably more of a marketing company than a whiskey company. And I think we can take a lot of examples out there of trying to figure out exactly, like, where do they play into this this sort of realm. But Ryan, kind of give your initial thoughts on it too.
Yeah, this is a tough one because there are brands that you do know that just buy the whiskey. You know, they don't necessarily go through all the barrels. They buy barrels from a sourced market. They go through, dump them, put them in a bottle, and then put it on the shelf. And then they have fancy packaging, fancy story. And to me, that's kind of, you know, the easy button and kind of, but there are source companies and whatnot that go, and they're very diligent about, even though they're sourcing, they're very diligent about, you know, focusing on barrel selection or doing the barrel maturation differently. They do different finishing. They do, you know, they hire, you know, a master blender or someone to help, or consultant to help be, you know, Blue Run's done this term beautifully, a liquid advisor, to kind of really make sure that that product stands up to the marketing. And so this is a tough one for me because, like, we know of hundreds of, probably 200s of brands that literally are just going to, you know, MGP, Green River, Bardstown, as you said, and just buying barrels, throwing them into a bottle and selling them. And, but you see those being very successful in the market, whereas you have some brands that really spend a lot of their money and effort on the product side, but they don't move or do as well because they're so focused on the liquid side of it, of the equation. And, you know, it's like, I don't know. I'm trying to tiptoe around this.
Yeah, that's fine. We can tap dance as much as we want.
Yeah.
And I kind of look at, and I'll put it out to here, is kind of figuring out, like, does the liquid really matter? Now, Fred, you kind of said, if it's shit, it's shit, right? That's a completely different thing. Now,
but then again, I've seen bad whiskey capture a market, and then anyone who comes out against it just gets tackled as a hater publicly. I've seen that with a few brands that have been out there, and they've ended up being successful. So I think even bad whiskey, if you do the marketing right, it captures an audience. Like when Hudson came out, there was not a stronger opinion from a traditional Kentucky bourbon fan than when Hudson came out. Everybody hated it in the traditional circles. But what Hudson did, it was just like, we don't give a crap about you, Kentucky bourbon drinkers. We're going after the hardcore New Yorker. We're going after New York. And they grew in New York. And then they created like this fandom of their flavor profile and the bottle. And they got a ton of press because, oh, bourbon can be made in New York. And this is before you all get into it. But that was like, that's a brand that focused on what their style of whiskey was and capitalized on it in the market. I mean, it's bad whiskey can do well, and bad whiskey is subjective. So just remember, if you don't like it, if we think it's trash, there's five people who like it.
Yeah. I guess what makes this discussion confusing, because I do talk about, you know, those companies that are just buying from those five main sources of sourced whiskey, the thing that gets confusing is because they make really good whiskey. But to me as a consumer, and it might be just, you know, because we're just too far entrenched in the whiskey geek world, that's not exciting enough for me as a consumer that, oh, you're just buying, getting barrels from these five sources. And, you know, we had this discussion when we first came out, the time you could buy 10 to 12 year old age Barton, and that would just be buying barrels, probably putting them into our bottles and selling them. And we said to ourselves, why would anyone buy that product from us when they can go buy the same exact product at $17.92 at $40 a bottle? But we were wrong. People fell into the stories. They fell into the marketing. And
maybe it's a dollar price point too.
The dollar price point. And so that's the conundrum is, I just don't think consumers are educated enough to understand that while they're just sourcing, throwing in a bottle, that doesn't necessarily mean anything to them.
Yeah. And I think the other point of that is too, is that you mentioned they're all good, and that's the problem. Like if they were all even just slightly mediocre, which depending on proof point, depending on the barrels you get, yeah, some of them can be just mediocre and it's fine. But as long as the packaging sells, then you're in a better position than somebody that spends a lot of time on triple distillation, heirloom corn, all this other kind of stuff. Like at the end of the day, does that really resonate to the consumer that's looking at the sea of bottles on the shelf and they're really thinking like, oh, I really want to find me some Jimmy Red Corn today? I don't think so. I think they're looking for a fancy bottle.
I don't know. I think 15 years ago, the answer to that would absolutely be no. But I think the whiskey geek consumer has multiplied and had babies in that time frame. And they do look for that. And there's a good example I have seen, and that's with particular ryes. When MGP kind of came out and dominated the rye category, that was like people who lean toward a different style of rye was just like, I got to try something else. And so that opened the market up a lot for craft ryes. And I saw an explosion of appreciation for Dad's Hat in Pennsylvania, for even like 291 in Colorado and, you know, a few others around the country. And that opened the door for a consumer to walk in who's a rye drinker. And a rye drinker is not always a bourbon drinker. When they go in there and they're looking at the bottles, I think they do look for some of those. Oh, there's four grains in that. Oh, there's two types of malt in this. Oh, I'm going to give that a shot. So I think there is just enough high-level education that it's not just fancy bottle buys today.
Yeah. And, you know, you mentioned 291 and folks like that. Like, those are whiskey companies, right? I mean, like, by far, like, those are whiskey companies. I think it's I don't know if I can think of a good example from a big distiller where it kind of really changes its focus a lot. And maybe this is really tough to kind of pin down because we have always said that it's like, okay, the big distillers, they get three different mash bills branded 50 different ways. Mm-hmm. So at what point do you find a difference in being a whiskey company versus being a marketing company when you take the same exact liquid and you just divide it up 30 different ways and put it a different label on it? And it's got, you know, this guy on this one, it's got this story of this heritage on this one, it's got a 7-year age statement on this one versus the other one that's 4. Like, at what point is that more just marketing versus being a whiskey company?
I think when you see them offering products that are the same thing, same age and everything at different proof points, the one that really sticks out to me is Weller. I think 1 year Weller's like, hey, we're going to do full proof, we're going to do single barrel, we're going to do 90 proof, 107 proof. And they did all these extensions within 1 year. And that really stuck out to me as like, that felt like just kind of a marketing grab.
They turned it into Beanie Babies.
Yeah.
You know, you got the different colors. You got the.
It didn't feel like the whole conversation was about the whiskey. Like, well, some people like it like this. I'm like, you know, I mean, it's a stretch because it wasn't like, what is foolproof? 115 proof?
120.
Is it 120?
No, actually, right. 115.
Yeah,
115. So, I mean, you're talking about the antique is 107. So that is not, it's not a big degree of separation. And then you got the next one, which is 90, and that's, you know, that is a little bit. But, and then they got their single barrel, which I can't recall what the proof on the single barrel is. But that all came out, those two products came out very close together, and that just felt like one of those marketing grabs. Now, if they were saying, like, we are going to be doing a Weller series that is going into our cold storage area, and we're releasing at 115 proof, two versions, you know, so you can taste side by side, that'd be different. And I should say that.
What do you think about Daniel Rue Weller?
Or Weller whatever, Daniel.
Oh, God.
Well, because, like, you know, yeah, they have Weller 12.
Yeah.
You know, and then they have Daniel
that's right.
That's $1,000 versus, you know, the
I didn't,
$60.
By the way, that was about the whiskey. That was, because they did a completely different profile on that, right? And the way they made it. And that was about the whiskey. A huge, you know, strikeout for me. I understand some people liked it, but that tasted like that did not hit for me. But I will say, you know, there's probably not a better modern company than Buffalo Trace when it comes to pushing the envelope on whiskey in terms of experimentation, in terms of finding out what works, what doesn't work. And they make it public. They'll also sell the bottles so consumers can see too, because they have that whole experimental collection. They have the single oak collection. Now they've got like colder temperatures for storage. They got Warehouse X. So they do a lot of things that are very focused on the whiskey. They turn it into marketing, sure, but they do the best job of any modern company since Seagram's of doing whiskey experiments.
Yeah, I would say that they do a perfect balance of it, to be honest with you. It's like you have to look and see what's working and you do it in the best idea of what's going to work well for the business. It's like, if you've got an engine that's going to pull the rest of the train, then if Weller is going to be the thing that people are going to latch onto, sure, why not? Exploit the hell out of it. Market the hell out of it. Like, I don't see a problem with it, and that's perfectly fine. I understand that from a whiskey geek perspective, we're kind of like, oh, here we go. Here's another proof or another color or whatever it is. It's the same. And that's why people chase after it, because they're like, oh, it's Pappy, but in a different bottle. It's not, but and that's just part of the thing, is like, it's just marketed differently. And people, I don't know if I'm going to say they fall into the trap, but they do a very good job of being able to explain that. And just the marketing thing as well is like, I kind of want to just touch on that more, because I feel like marketing is really going to trump all this. that you could have, like I said, mediocre whiskey in a bottle. It could be okay, just good enough. It doesn't have to blow your socks off. But man alive, if you've got a great package, you got a great story, and you hit a price point that is able to sort of resonate with consumers, I feel like you have a winning category. Now, the other thing I look at this is, how do you transition from being a marketing company to a whiskey company? And I think Penelope did that very well, because at the very beginning, what were they doing? They had their 80 proof white label. It was 3 years old, called a four grain kind of MGP, their own blend. Okay, right?
And then they extended that to like the barrel strength. And then that was pretty much it, right?
Well, at the start, it was that. And then you went toasted. Then you went Valencia. Then you went all these different things. And they finally like found a groove, right? They became somebody that said like, oh, we're going to blend our own special MGP. I don't care. I'm going to be in this camp that it's like, dude, you're getting barrels from MGP. It's going to taste like other MGP out there. I've had a bunch of it, and it all just, it's kind of just all is in the same ballpark, right? Does it hit some of the notes? Yeah, sure. It's good. But I mean, I would say it's all average, right? I mean,
yeah.
Anybody that's an MGP company out there, sorry, that's just how I feel. It's still good. It's just not great, in my opinion. And it's just, it's the same bottle in a different, or same whiskey in a different bottle.
I would say the best MGP is when the barrels are aged somewhere else. Like the Indiana bourbon that was aged at Smooth Ambler. I mean, it's some of the best bourbon that came out this century. I mean, it's just, it's at higher elevation there. I think one of the best companies ever with playing with MGP is Smokewagon. Smokewagon, you know, he does his own thing with them. It gets a little bit of that Nevada environment. And he's taken his whiskey. He's made it known that his whiskey is different than everybody else's. And Aaron is the face of that brand and is always out there telling his story, marketing. And, you know, he's not spending money on that. And so he has a lot of price variables that are not high. So I think of all the people who have played around with the MGP thing. You mentioned Penelope. Penelope's very close. You know, I think what really was a home run for Penelope was their bottle. Just something about a big giant P, simple for everybody. You always
P in the etching, or not the etching, but the flower.
Yeah.
The flowers. And
you see that bottle once, it's in your brain, you know? Like, it sticks. And Smokewagon's very similar. It's got a great package.
That's what I was going to say. I was like, Smokewagon does very well, by the way. I'm not trying to diss or shit on anything like that. They do very well. I would say that the broader majority of the market, the people that are picking up Smokewagon bottles, they don't know who the hell Aaron is. They don't know who he is, right? I mean, I know he's got some fandom on Instagram, but we were just talking to another distributor the other day in one of our states that we're in, and he told us how many cases Smokewagon did in their state. I mean, it 4X'd what we did just in our 9 states. And I'm kind of like, all right, there's no way he's doing that through Instagram.
Yeah, because
it's marketing. It's the bottle.
It's also a price point. Like his,
yeah, I agree.
His small batch is under
like $40 or something.
It's under $40. And it's like, that's just hard to come by today, especially for that model, you know? So he's making a business decision to sell lower than he could. I mean, he could sell that for that small batch for $60-$70.
I don't know. Today's market's changed. I think everybody's looking for that smaller one. And but he had foresight, right?
Yeah.
I mean, we talked about this when we interviewed him years ago about how he was putting down whiskey at MGP long before he was actually able to sell it. And so his cost of goods went way down. And so he's able to capture a lot of those different price points. Plus, you can see he's got different bottles. Not all of them are the embossed. There's some that are just the labels, but you stand them all next to each other on a shelf and it catches your eye.
Yeah. I mean, I'm a fan of what he's done. And he's also in a situation where he can always say, I'd love to distill here, but you know, Nevada blocks me from getting the amount of water I need. So he can always have that argument in his back pocket. And he's also comes from the bartending side. So he knows the business inside out. So he can talk. When we talk about marketing, it's not just like a pamphlet or a bottle. I mean, it's actually, it's going and having meetings with the trade. It's doing things that make sense. This is a very trade heavy industry, and if you can't appeal to the distributor, to the retailer, to the bartender, to the beverage purchaser at a casino, you don't go anywhere. You don't get in front of the consumer hardly ever. So he has the ability to talk many levels, and he's very good at it.
Yeah. And I think one of the things that we might find harder as we go through here, we've been, Ryan and I, we've talked to other retailers, talked to other distributors, and the first thing they ask us is, all right, so is this more MGP? Right. And I think that's going to be a bigger conversation as we go longer, and the companies that are trying to establish themselves built on MGP and how they're going to make themselves truly stand out and be different. I think that's another conversation for another day. You know, Ryan, you'd mentioned Green River. Green River makes a lot of fantastic whiskey. And there's a lot of brands out there that say Kentucky Straight Bourbon on it, and people don't know it's Green River, and you can get the same.
That's right.
But here's the thing. Green River has kind of shot themselves in the foot, because I don't know why they just don't put out cash strength single barrels. Because that stuff would just demolish anything else.
The hard thing for, you know, as a brand that sources is now, you know, MGP, Green River, Bardstown, they all have their own brands, in-house brands. So, you know, you're sourcing from Bardstown exclusively or Green River exclusively. Well, Green River comes out with their product, great whiskey,
$30. $5, yeah.
And if you're buying whiskey from them, how do you, and you're just taking Green River, bottling it, how do you compete, you know, against their main brand? Same thing with Bardstown. You know, they came out, you know, they had their hire with Discoveries and what, you know, all the different collaborations and whatnot. But when they came out with their Origin series, and I remember when they came out with the price, I texted, you know, them, and I was like, damn you all, you know,
how are we going to compete?
How do we compete against you all? If, you know, if you're at $40 and we can, the lowest we can go is 65, you know, it's like that, that's a hard part. And that's why we ended up, and I'm not trying to make this about us, but that's why we ended up sourcing from multiple places and focusing on blending. But I do think you're going to have the same issue, you know, companies that, like you said, distributors are like, oh, is this just another MGP? I think they're going to be like, oh, is this just another Green River? Or is this another Bardstown? Or is this another?
This is where does it matter? Because
I know, that's,
because is it marketing at the end of the day? It's like, if you can prove yourself in one market, right? I think there's a lot of brands out there that have proven themselves is that they can go direct to seal box and they can sell out 2,000 bottles in a week because it's Kentucky Straight Bourbon, it's cash strength. We always kind of go back to this. Like there's three things that the whiskey geek chases after, right? Is it cash strength? Does it have a high age statement? And is it allocated or is it rare, right? That's the only thing that people care about in our world. And so it's like, if you can kind of hit on like a few of those different topics and you can sell out, well, you can prove a model. So it really doesn't matter if you go to a retailer and you go to a distributor and you say, well, listen, like, we could sell out quick. Like, look at this packaging. Like, look at what we've done previously. It doesn't really matter what's in the bottle. We don't have a story. We just have a really nice, I mean, maybe it's a fictional story or whatever it is. But if you can package it in something that is just eye-catching, I mean, that's the thing that we've learned the most. Like, when you went to Moonshine University and they talked about when consumers are at the shelves and they're looking around, like, what draws their attention? What pulls their eye? If you're anything like me, then you can't get enough about bourbon. And that's why I'm a subscriber to Bourbon Plus magazine. Bourbon Plus is a quarterly publication that tells the stories from the heart of bourbon. The farmers who grow the grain, the distillers who labor over the process, and the people, like you and me, who raise their glasses to celebrate it all. Subscribe to Bourbon Plus magazine today at bourbonplus.com, that's P-L-U-S.com, and use code PURSUIT at checkout for $5 off your subscription. Customers are rushing to your store. Do you have a point of sale system you can trust, or is it a real POS? You need Shopify for retail. Shopify POS is your command center for your retail store. From accepting payments to managing inventory, Shopify has everything you need to sell in person. And with Shopify, you get a powerhouse selling partner that effortlessly unites your in-person and online sales into one source of truth. Track every sale across your business in one place and know exactly what's in stock. Connect with customers in line and online. Shopify helps you drive store traffic with plug-and-play tools built for marketing campaigns from TikTok to Instagram and beyond. And you can get hardware that fits your business. Take payments by smartphone, transform your tablet into a point-of-sale system, or use Shopify's POS Go mobile device for a battle-tested solution. Plus, Shopify's award-winning 24/7 help is there to support your success every step of the way. Do retail right with Shopify. Sign up for $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/bourbon, all lowercase, and go to shopify.com/bourbon to take your retail business to the next level today. Shopify.com/bourbon. When consumers are at the shelves and they're looking around, like, what draws their attention? What pulls their eye? It's not a story, right? It's gold foil. It's
the bottle height.
Yeah.
Where it is on the shelf. You know, if you're in between 6 foot and 5'5" or where 5'6", if you're in those, in that level on the shelf, that's where most people's going to see. They're not going to look down. They're not going to look up. They're going to see, that's their first instinct, is seeing that right there. So it's all, you know, about bottle placement. And then sometimes you have to pay for that bottle placement, or you got to do case displays to get that out there. And, or you got to, you know, try to do shelf tags or hangers, something to catch the consumer's eyes out there in the market.
Yeah. And I think there's a really good example of that is you can go to Total Wine. And what do you see in Total Wine? You see their house brands everywhere, right? K-Stacked, it's everywhere. It's Wolcott, it's this. And there's nothing wrong with it. I'm sure the whiskey's okay, but what do they focus on? It's marketing, 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 and price point. And it works. There's a reason why they do this. If they didn't sell a crap ton of it, they wouldn't do it. So there is something to be said about just being more focused on the marketing than just on the whiskey.
Right. Yeah. I mean, that's unfortunate. I think that's just the world we live in. It's like, even if you take a shoe company or a pant company, like, I mean, it's hard to create something unique. And you kind of see this, you know, Vuori is a wonderful example about this. Like, they created this kind of lifestyle. They found this community that was, you know, focused on men who were doing workout classes, who wanted to do workout, but also show up to a workout class and go have drinks or go out, go to work. And so they create a line of products that almost this lifestyle kind of brand. And that kind of seems the way that whiskey is kind of going too, is like, you're trying to create almost a product that finds a consumer and tells that consumer the story that they want to hear, so that they take that bottle, take it home, and it fulfills that rolling story in their head about who they are as a person, what they drink, what they do in the world. And so, you know, unfortunately, I think all products have kind of lost, like, from the product focus, because everything is quality, everything is good. You have to, that has to be just like the non-negotiable, you know, everything has to be a good quality. But then from there, you have to build these things that lure in consumers, and marketing is that most important part of it.
I mean, one of the brands that I kind of admire that does a pretty good balance of this is kind of Blue Run. You know, they kind of came out the gate and they said that it was really more along the lines of marketing. That's what I saw when I saw their
right
their brand. I said, well, this is great packaging. You know, you talk about your liquid advisor, you talk about this, but at the end of the day, what was it? It was 12-year Barton in another bottle, right? Yep. Now, whatever
picked
it is.
Picked by Jim Rutledge, or, you know, Jim had a hand in it. I think that part is important.
Okay.
Having a palate.
Fred, picked by Jim Rutledge. They've already said that they've ran out of those stocks, so it doesn't really matter.
Well, I'm like, saying
they
I'm
used
saying
every
early,
single one already, so
early
they
on,
bought whatever and put it in the bottle.
Early on, Jim had a hand.
Well, I mean, even if a Jim was there, like I said, they
but
bought
I think
all
that's
those
part of the marketing story, first. Too. Is
but,
like that,
but also, yeah. Like, Blue Run never tickled my fancy like yours, but when they won San Francisco, I was not a judge there, but that's when, you know, that's the kind of like moment, you know, you had to have a great whiskey palate to get something that would win San Francisco. And they won San Francisco. And so that to me was when they got put on the map. So they marketed the living shit out of that, I would say, and they hung their hat on that as they should. But that was when, and that was Jim Rutledge.
Yeah.
But yeah, I think Blue Run, like I totally respect what they do. They do spend a lot of money and effort on the whiskey. They hired Shaylin, you know, to really focus on the art of blending, selection, maturation. I think, you know, Blue Run, where they run into, if they were priced like at sub $75, I think it would probably fly more off the shelves. But because it is that like $100 mark, and it's non-age stated, and you know, I know, and most consumers,
the butterfly
don't
costs $50 though.
Well, I know the packaging is very expensive, and I understand everything they put into it probably makes them have to price it accordingly. But I just think if it, they could somehow find a way, you know, maybe with Coors buying them out, they can get better contract negotiations with volume and whatnot to where they can get the cost of goods down. You know, and they came out of a time where it was during the pandemic, a lot of people had more disposable income because they weren't traveling, they weren't going out to eat. You know, there was a lot of stimulus money going out around, people were at home drinking a lot. And so they were able to hit that magic time frame of COVID where people would be willing to spend that much money. But that, as we've seen, not just them, but a lot of brands, as we've moved out of the pandemic years, that $100 price point is a really tough area to play. And it was like that before COVID, like $100 price point plus was really tough to play. And so it'll be interesting. You know, I think whiskey companies tried to push bourbon to this premium product. And I don't necessarily think the market is necessarily there on a mass scale.
No, it's not. It's not Scotch selling for $2.8 million, which is or $2.7 million, which has happened recently. But, you know, I will say, like, we're talking about Blue Note.
Blue Run.
We're talking about Blue Run.
You're talking about Blue Note, too.
I like Blue Note because they have a really great price point. That whiskey is very good.
And what'd they do? They got some good source, and they finished it with French oak. Isn't that what, like, Juke Joint is or something like that? It's Kentucky source.
Yeah, they have, you know, they have their flagship Blue Note. Then they have the Juke Joint. And then they have the Cash Shrink, but then they have the Crossroads, which is the French
Crossroads.
Yeah, the Crossroads.
So if I have to choose between the blues, I would pick Blue Note over Blue Run, even though I get them confused all the time. There's like five other blues, but I'm like, they haven't even registered in the brain well enough yet.
Yeah. But I mean, you look at something like, I think let's talk about Blue Note. I mean, you look at that, I think it's somebody that did the same exact thing. They kind of started off as they tried to do a marketing play at first, right? It was a bunch of source Dickel stuff, put in a bottle, hope for the best. And at some point, and that's, I think maybe the critical point is that when these other brands, that all you're doing is if you're just sourcing liquid and you're putting into a bottle, I mean, I'm not going to call anybody out, but there's just so many of them out there. What makes you different? What makes you want to be a whiskey company? Because you've got to figure out what's going to be your differentiator in the marketplace to go and build that. But now I just keep going back. It's like, does it even matter? Like, if you can focus on making sure that your branding is on point, your story resonates. And here's the thing is that we keep talking about the one percenters of bourbon, the people that listen to this podcast, people that pay attention to Fred Minnick, the one percenters of bourbon. You've got the other segment of the market, which basically dominates anything that we do. And if that hits, you don't have to be with the neophytes. You need to be with the majority of the market. If you think about that bell curve about what's there, If you hit that middle section, that's gold. And you just have to make sure you can hit those marks every single time.
It's interesting. Do you want to be Jack Daniels or do you want to be Pappy? I think that's kind of where people go back and forth. Jack Daniels makes a lot more money and that brand's a lot more valuable. So, yeah.
I think this comes down to pricing, really, because when you are focused on the whiskey and differentiated, that your cost of goods are going to go way up.
That's right.
Whether you're sourcing and you're trying to differentiate because you're finishing, that's added cost, or you're focused on blending, getting different sources, that adds cost. If you're, you know, if you're working with heirloom grains, doing small
distillation. I was about to say, we haven't really talked about grains.
Yeah, I mean, like New Riff, working with grains, that's been their differentiator. They have a fantastic product, but it's kind of priced higher than, you know, something like Blue Note Juke Joint. I think Blue Note's been very successful because of that price point. It's, you know, it's Kentucky straight bourbon. It's good. It's not like mind blowing, but it's $35 a bottle. And I think that's the pricing is the most important piece of your success and what can, I guess, determine if you're going to be focusing on the whiskey or the marketing.
Mm-hmm. I guess it's a bigger question is like, if you were to put your dollars into it, Fred, let's go with you. We already have a brand, so we're kind of biased.
We're doing everything wrong. So
yeah.
We're going to listen to you.
So let's say you wanted to start a brand and as much as...
Which I don't.
Much as Fred Minnick is Fred Minnick and...
Not going to do it, but I'll go through this.
And everybody thinks highly of you, but let's be honest. You know, you go to the airport and you're sitting there riding coach with the rest of us, right? So what do you do? Like, do you put your money more in the marketing side? Like, let's get
the
our
airport?
Liquid,
or in the...
I'm just saying.
I'm just thinking about this coach. Can I upgrade? You know, I mean...
You're on Spirit. I'm sorry. I'm just kidding with you. I'm just trying to say you're a regular Joe like one of
that's
us.
That's right. That's right.
And so when you want to come out with a brand, now let's say you have a pool of money, right? And you could spend that pool of money and make a really, really good whiskey, or you can have something that says like, listen, this is good enough, and this would register on the Fred Minnick scale of 92, we'll say, maybe 91.
Do I want a volume play, or do I want a high-end level?
You want to make a living, all right? Yeah. Let's say that. You want to make a living. And how do you go from Fred Minnick, the reviewer, the critic, and saying, like, this is my whiskey, to saying, like, all right, now I've got to get this in the hands of 50,000 people across the U.S. who have no idea who I am?
First of all, I would not do this.
I love the hypotheticals.
Second of all, I would, if I were to do this, I would not be taking on the brunt of the responsibility. I'd make sure that I was surrounded by a team that was smarter than me in every facet. And I would say, like, if I was not aligned with one of the major groups, like, right away, I just wouldn't go.
What do you mean groups?
Like
kind of what like Dixon did, right? When he came out with
Duke.
Are you talking about like something like that?
No, I would say like I would need to have some type of arrangement where distribution was automatic. Like I would be a part of a portfolio. Like that right there, that before I would even consider starting doing anything, I would make sure that I could, if I wanted to, be distributed in all 50 states through a particular network. Whether that's associated with one of the major brands or whether that's having an agreement right away with Southern or RNDC or someone like that. That's the first step that I would do. I would not do anything until I had a guarantee that I would have distribution, because I would never, ever, ever, ever want to sit down in a market.
Okay.
And
well,
have
there
a
goes
meeting.
$15 a case.
There you go. So you just put money towards marketing.
Okay. Yeah. Yeah. I mean that would be that. And then I would probably focus on a 6-year-old, 100-proof, small batch, and it wouldn't necessarily be somewhere, you know, I would probably focus more on like a nice volume play.
Yeah. Well, I hate to tell you, you're going to have to go out to market, because even Graham McTavish has to go out to market. And,
no, I know
and so I'm do gonna, Brothers Bond. They still have to do it, even though they're no, all just putting I, MGP in a bottle.
I know I would go out to market. I know that. But what I'm saying is I don't want to have to, if I were to do this, honestly, I would rather be signed on with a major company than have to bootstring it along. I don't want that. When I said at the very top, I don't want to do a brand. I've been approached by some of the majors about doing a brand. I don't want to do it.
We got you.
And people are always like, hey, you can make more money. It's this. I don't do this. I do fine, but I don't do this for like making a crap ton of money. I do this because I love it. And I don't feel like I'd love it, honestly.
It might actually make you resent whiskey.
Yeah. If I had to do what you all have to do to build a brand, I don't think I would love it. And so I would need to put myself in a position where I would still love something that, quite frankly, you know, saved my life in some ways. You know, I love bourbon. I love this category. I love whiskey. I love the people. And I love tasting everything responsibly, of course. But the amount of stress and shit that people have to go through and fight in every individual market just to get a shelf space, it's exhausting. Yeah. I couldn't do it.
I think what we learned right here is that the easy part is actually the liquid. That's the easiest part
yes.
of this all.
I would, yes, absolutely.
And
yes.
There was two names you brought up, McTavish and
Vampire.
Yeah. The Vampire Boys.
Ian Somerhalder.
Yes. Yep. And so to me, I would see those as marketing companies, not whiskey companies. And they do very well because
Man,
of that.
I'll take up for Ian.
And I'm not, and I don't know
they're,
them.
They're blending. He's actually blending. Like he's blending his stuff. Like, I mean, he's blending it in smaller samples. He's not at the distillery, but he's actually at MGP quite a bit. So I don't know, man. Like that's like one guy that's done it right from that world.
I think what we should do is we should just get a bunch of the same stuff we know in a different bottle, put them all against each other and kind of see what we we think of it. Maybe that's going to be another.
Oh, we should do an MGP episode.
And another live.
When we did the bottle and bond taste off?
Yeah, we'll do a live blind. Oh, we should all do that. There we go. We just thought of a new idea.
Yeah.
Do the best of MGP?
Yeah. Something like who's that. The best whiskey company using MGP?
That's interesting. I'm doing a blind bourbon doing that. In Lawrenceburg, Indiana, actually. Yep. By the time this airs, it'll be over, though.
I bet you it's going to taste all like baking spices.
Remus.
Yeah, it's Remus at the end of the day.
Especially if it's the repeal.
Yeah.
It's usually pretty good.
Yeah. But, okay, we're wrapping up here. I think this has been a good, healthy conversation because going back to what we said at the very beginning of the show, like, there's nothing wrong either way you go with this.
No, definitely not.
And in fact, that's what I said is, like, even if you think you're a whiskey company, but in reality you're a marketing company, that's okay. Like, yeah. There's nothing wrong with that.
Like Bernie Lubbers always says, we're not in the bourbon charity. We're in the bourbon business. And you got to make money to keep your brand or whatever going. And so, you know, you have to have a balance of both. It's just fascinating from a consumer's mindset and trying to understand what makes them gravitate. Coming from the whiskey geek world, that sometimes you're just like, kind of just scratching your head. You're like, okay, the liquid side doesn't necessarily matter really to most consumers. It's about the story, the packaging, the price point. That's what it's about. And as Fred mentioned too, most people understand the very most important part is the relationships with distributors and retailers. That's the most challenging hurdle to get a past.
Yeah. All right. I got one more brand I'll throw out there and see if we can find divisible sides. Because I love, of course, this brand and the people behind it. Old Carter.
Okay.
Marketing company? Or a whiskey company?
I would say originally a wine company.
Yeah, absolutely.
And they approach it as a wine company. They've taken a lot of strategies and techniques that I saw when I covered wine and applied it to bourbon. And it's not just with the label. It's with their marketing. It's with the
gravitas. The thing is they do a lack of marketing.
Exactly.
Which actually kind of helps.
Yeah. French. That's the French style. And that's very much in the wine world, a lack of marketing is kind of like, it's good. Like, and it's old school wine, but the chateaus on the labels, that and being, you know, left bank, right bank, Bordeaux, Burgundy, those things mattered on a label. So they created a lot of their stuff just around this, like, kind of like wine, and you see it. So I would say that their entire approach comes from, it's just like when people have a military background and they apply it to the real world, they're like, oh, it's because he's military. And I would say their entire approach has been very old world wine approach. And that's it's a strange way to phrase it, but that is to make it feel like that it's about the whiskey, and it is about the whiskey, but you've got all of these other little points where you have other people talking about it, and they're better than anybody at getting other people talking about their whiskey, and that is indeed marketing. So I don't know what's more important, because those people don't talk about it unless the whiskey's good. So I'd say they're a whiskey company, but it's close.
It's a toss-up. It is, because they, you know, I hate to say it, and I don't mean anything, but
especially if you're listening, Mark.
Not, and this has nothing to do with Mark, but they've done a great job. I mean, and the products are always fantastic. Where I kind of look at companies and say that's a marketing company and a whiskey company is when they come out with a light whiskey that every single person on the market has came out with. You've seen Old Carter have that light whiskey. You've seen Penelope. You've seen Ride 3, Doc Swenson, all these different brands. It's the same.
That's because MGP's got to push it.
Comes open, and then they're like, well,
it's a high age statement and high proof. Mm-hmm. And those are two things that people care about.
Exactly. And
it's less about the whiskey.
But I would say they're a whiskey company. I mean, they're very, you know, keeping the batches small, high quality, high age statements. They do a lot of the blending barrel selections themselves. So for the most part, but like Fred said, they do market it by not marketing it. They kind of give this allure that this is for, you know, with the price point, like the limited access that they're downtown. Yeah. This is like a brand for those kind of elite whiskey geeks that know, understand good whiskey, high age stated. It kind of creates this little bubble of a very niche market, I think.
And what's interesting, I left them off my top 100. next to 13th Colony, I probably got as many old Carter fans coming at me for saying, like, how could you leave off an old Carter? And the thing about old Carter, a lot of their stuff that I've had is single barrel, right? A lot of the stuff is like, it was really good a single barrel. And that's just, those just aren't eligible for my top 100. But like, to see like fans, like you see this with brands like Penelope has fans that will come after you if you give them a bad review. Smoke Wagon has fans that'll come after you. And so does Old Carter. Without any marketing, they have the fans that will fight for them on the socials.
Yeah. I think we could probably go to 20 different brands and kind of pick these apart. But that was one that I just kind of thought in my head. And I was like, that's a really good one.
How about Maker's Mark?
They're a whiskey company. I think that when I look at them, they had to separate themselves by marketing better.
Mm-hmm.
But at the end of the day, they're still a whiskey company. I think they
wrote the book on whiskey marketing, though.
Well, I agree. You know. That's why I said it's kind of hard to look at some of the big companies and whether they're a whiskey company or marketing company, because they're making their own whiskey. Like, if you're making your own whiskey, I think it's kind of hard to sit there and be like, wow, we're really focused on marketing.
I think I failed to see the point of the entire episode until just now. We were supposed to talk about distillers.
Yeah.
Sorry about that.
No, it's
not. I did pretty good, though.
But I don't know, to counter that point, and I know we're getting short on time, it's like, you know, I asked this question at an event dealer, and I was like, has anyone been to a distillery? How many have you been to? How different are they? And they're like, they're not.
Yeah.
And it's like, you know, when you get to that level, you have such a refined process that it's almost a commodity. You know, it's not really necessarily where you're, you know, whiskey and bourbon is this spirit that doesn't rely on, you know, you're cleaning it up so much through column distillation that
that's right.
You're really, a lot of the flavors coming from the barrel and the maturation side. And so while these big distilleries are making their own whiskey, and you know, that's what I think kind of is cool with, like, you know, Jim Beam creating this other distillery for like Freddie No to kind of really work on different grains, different mash bills, different, you know, things to like experiment with. And you kind of see that at other brands. Buffalo Trace has the experimental collection and whatnot. But so I don't know, that kind of muddies the waters as well. Is like, is it truly a whiskey company when it's just a factory, you know, making?
Well, I would say that, boy, Chuck Cowdery, he hates the word factory when referencing the larger distillers. I've seen him eviscerate people online about that. And he, you know, of course, he's the guy who wrote the book on the books. So I would say they all have some kind of whiskey. They're all, the larger ones are all whiskey companies. But if they don't have a marketing arm, you know, they're dead in the water. Like Green River didn't have a marketing arm. They were not doing well. Right. You know, they had nothing. In fact, they had a negative because they had Ozzie Tyler attached to it. It was another one that didn't really have a marketing arm.
But they did a big 180, though, and they turned a lot of things.
They did the 180, but the damage was done. And, you know, if they didn't get bought out, you know, I don't know what would have happened. But they would eventually got bought anyway. But I look at Maker's Mark, and the reason why I brought up Maker's Mark is that all of their marketing is about their red dripping wax. And when Blanton's came out in the 80s, they started doing campaigns going up against Maker's Mark, saying like, oh, I guess your whiskey's not that good. All you talk about is the wax. And so they would take full page newspaper ads out in the early 90s in Kentucky. And Maker's finally, Maker's got a taste of its own medicine because they did that with Jack Daniels for a long time, finding a guy named Jack Daniel and doing a series of ad campaigns saying, hey, everybody, look, Jack Daniels loves Maker's Mark. So they got a taste of their own medicine. So they did this taste off, you know, of a blind tasting with consumers in Lexington and Louisville to find out who was the champion of Kentucky. Lexington went to Blanton's and Louisville went to Maker's Mark.
Their own Pepsi challenge kind of backfired it a little bit, huh?
Yeah. Yeah. But it's interesting. Their marketing is about the wax. If you're a brand and if you play with the wax, you try to do your own dripping wax, they'll sue you.
Yeah, and I think they also transitioned maybe a little bit more into a whiskey company, because what happened as soon as Bill Samuels started getting a little bit older, you had Makers 46, you had the Private Select program, you got Cellar Age, you got the these different things that are the wood finishing series.
Yeah, like they were,
I think they had to try to finally be.
They were expanding their portfolio because the market was changing, and what was really pushing them to change was Four Roses. And the high spice, the high rye bourbons, bourbons that had spice versus a softer approach, which Makers is, and that was pushing them. And I remember writing about that. Good Lord, that was 15 years ago now, and it was kind of like, even at that time, it was like, it's about time you all do something different. I mean, Jack Daniel's had even transitioned into Gentleman Jack and other things at this point. And Maker's Mark was just kind of like, no, we're just going to do Makers. Just going to do Makers. So it is fascinating. Maker's Mark to me is one of the most fascinating brands and distilleries, because when they replace a still, they have three column stills there, y'all. Three column stills that are tiny in comparison to Buffalo Trace and Jack Daniel's. They're tiny. And they get the original, they continue ordering another still, and they'll put a dent in it that's the same as the original still. And so they have like all of these like old school kind of like things that they do, but their approach of marketing is still very new school. They're a fascinating company to me.
Yeah, they are. But this has been a fun conversation in general. I think this might be something that we would even potentially do again. It's like, if you're an avid listener out there and you want us to, I don't know, maybe get a list of brands if some people always talk about it. Maybe we'll do it. Maybe not to piss people off, but who knows?
And by the way, someone will say, well, this is a ridiculous episode because everyone's a whiskey company. And if you got to this far and that was your take from this episode, I'm just going to say, you don't get it.
Yeah, wait till you're on Ryan and I's side of the fence. And then you look around, you're like, shit, why do we put so much effort in doing this to our whiskey and making it different when all we had to do is just go buy Green River and put in a bottle and slap a name on it? But there's,
swear to God, I don't want to do it.
If you ever get to that day, we'll consult for you and we'll
tell you exactly what not to do.
I'm out. It ain't happening. Only way it happens is if someone comes to me and is like, it makes me an offer I can't refuse, which I highly doubt that's possible.
Yeah, I'd say so too, because we can't. Well, actually, we're not going to refuse anything right now. So come with the offers.
Yep.
I'm just messing, but this has been a fun conversation. So if you like episodes like the send us a line podcast@bourbonpursuit.com. And if you like the show, share it with a friend. You can leave a review, but more likely share it with a friend. And also follow our good buddy Fred Minnick over here. Follow Bourbon Pursuit on all your socials. But with that, everybody, cheers, and we'll see you next time.
Toodles.
Go Pokes.